You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Josh Goff, here on behalf of Mr. Lewis. May I please reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
The issue of this case is whether Mr. Lewis had two prior predicate assault and battery on a family member convictions at the time of his last conviction on May 5th of 2016. In Mr. Lewis's case, it's not in dispute. He had one prior conviction from 2011 that was introduced as a certified copy from the Newport News Juvenile Domestic Relations District Court. And the Commonwealth, in seeking to enhance the penalty under 18.257.2, tried Mr. Lewis on the same day, May 5th, 2016, on two separate assault and battery on a family member charges involving the same complaining witness. At the conclusion of trial number one, the October 9th, 2015 offense date, the trial court verbally said that it found Mr. Lewis guilty of assault and battery on a family or household member. Mr. Lewis requested a pre-sentence report, as was his right, and the case was set over several months later to July of 2016. The Commonwealth then proceeded to try Mr. Lewis on an indictment which had already alleged that he had twice before been previously convicted of assault and battery on a family member.
Why don't we get right to the major issue in this case? Under this statute, 18.257.2, when does a conviction take place?
A conviction, as a number of cases that have been cited by both counsel in this case, is when a sentencing order is signed by the judge. A conviction encompasses a sentence on the judgment. Or at the very least, it is when the trial court enters an order, since a court speaks only through its orders, when the court enters an order memorializing what happened at the trial. In this case, that did not happen until May 16th of 2016, about 2 weeks after the May 5th, 2016 date.
The Commonwealth accurately states that the word conviction has a number of different meanings depending on context. There's a reference in the brief that in that respect it's ambiguous. I understand the Commonwealth to say that in a generic way it's ambiguous, but in a specific context it is not ambiguous. For example, we have cases that say this under this statute, we have cases that say this under that statute, and now we have 18.257.2, and the Commonwealth's position is it's not ambiguous under that statute. I think I'm reading the Commonwealth correctly, but we'll certainly find out before the day's over. In the past 7 to 8 years, this court has handed down a number of opinions on a parallel issue. That's the authority of a trial court to take a matter under advisement and then dismiss it later. And these cases, Stars is actually cited, but Moreau, Hernandez, and Hackett are not cited by any side in this case. In those cases, The final analysis is that until an order of conviction is entered, the court has all kinds of discretion to do whatever they want with the evidence they've heard. Take it under advisement, I'll see you in a year. But once the judge enters an order of conviction, that's the end of the game. The judge doesn't have any authority after that to change that order. And it seems to me that that is the analysis that most fits this statute. So if you look at this and you say, the statute says, such person has been previously convicted of two offenses. What you're saying is that there's no doubt about it. He's been convicted. You can't take it under advisement. You can't change it. You can't do anything with it. He's convicted of two offenses against a family or household member, etc. It would seem to me that in this case, you've argued in the alternative. One is that it's a conviction is when sentencing takes place. And your other argument is in the alternative, it takes place when a conviction order is entered and is a judgment of guilt. that right?
Yes, sir.
Well, your position is consistent with how the orders are denominated. The orders in this case are called conviction orders by the judge. And they happen to be form orders that are used by the Supreme Court of Virginia, but the judge uses them, and they're conviction orders. So that leaves you, it seems to me, with only one avenue. And that's what I want you to answer and focus on, if you will. In June 9th, 2011, there was a conviction of a misdemeanor under this statute. Correct?
Yes, sir.
All right, there's one. May 16th, 2016, there are two convictions. One is out of an offense date of October 9, 2015. The other is on an offense date of December 24, 2015. But we don't care about the offense date, because that's not what this statute is about. We care about the conviction date. So the question is, if you have two convictions, which you do, on the same day, how can one be prior? And that seemed to me your best argument.
Well, I agree with that, and that's the point that I referenced when that there was no conviction on May 5th of 2016. And that's clear. The court speaks only through its orders. There was no order of conviction at the time that the Commonwealth proceeded with the second trial. So if the court adopts, and the court clearly did call these conviction orders, which I know is standard. So if the court adopts that line of reasoning that the conviction happened on the date that the order was signed, that date was still after the trial of the May 5th, the second trial of May 5th, 2016, and signed on the same day as the second conviction order, and therefore it did not precede it, which the statute does call for under 18.257.2.
So your alternative position is that at the very least, this felony conviction should be a misdemeanor, and it ought to be sent back for sentencing accordingly.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm clearly not saying there wasn't sufficient evidence in this case for a finding of guilt.
Pretty bad, wasn't it?
Yeah. But there was not sufficient evidence for the finding under 18.257.2, paragraph B, to enhance it to the Class 6 felony.
Right. I'm going to be asking the Commonwealth this question, but I'll give you a shot at it first, and they'll listen and know it's coming up. All right? On May 16, 2016, there were two conviction orders. Do you determine that one is prior to the other based on minutes on the clock or based on days?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, there's just no indication from the record as to which was prior. I mean, they're both signed by the trial court. They're both dated May 16th, 2016. The trial court could have very well, if they were both placed on his desk, just sitting in a pile, he might have grabbed the second one first and signed that.
Which is my point. Is that you'll never really be able to demonstrate that one way or the other. So it has to be days.
Yes, sir.
Right?
That would be my position.
So back to the first question I had, and that is, can two conviction orders entered on the same day, can one truly be said to be prior to the other?
No, Your Honor.
Why not? If I'm a trial judge and I've got this case on my docket and I've docketed it for today and I know I need to enter one conviction order ahead of the other one in order to do the enhanced punishment, I have to do one today and then call everybody back tomorrow?
The record would have to... my position would be that at the time on May 5th when we did the second trial, clearly there was no conviction order introduced by the Commonwealth into evidence that day.
But the point I'm asking about is, you have the burden of proof. The Commonwealth doesn't have to prove anything on appeal. You have to show that if, in fact, one was before the other, and that has a dispositive legal effect, which is still an open question, that the wrong one was put before the other. But you've just admitted, quite as you should, of course, there's no way of knowing. So, under that logic, the only way for you to win the point is to say, it's as a matter of law, you cannot sequence orders in the course of a calendar day. And that's just a proposition I've never seen printed anywhere in any legal case.
Well, to get back to Chief Justice Lemon's point, whether we calculate these by minutes in a day or by day, we have to calculate them by day because that's the only way to do it.
But why? If I'm a trial judge and I enter an injunction at 9 a.m. and a TRO follow a TRO at 9 a.m. and at 2 p.m. someone says they violated your TRO already, Judge Kelsey, I'm going to be enforcing it. And it would be frivolous if someone came to me and said, oh, but your TRO order was entered simultaneously with your contempt order, and that put the cart before the horse. I'd go, no, the horse was at 9, and the cart was at 3 in the afternoon.
Well, in this case, there would have to be some sort of language contained in the order indicating that one preceded the other. And in this case, the record does not allow us.
But that presupposes that it's the Commonwealth's burden to show that. You have the burden on appeal to show that the sequencing was wrong. And no criticism of your position, you can't. It's not possible to.
But it would be impossible because it would involve, I mean, by statute, I cannot call the trial court, solicit an affidavit or some sort of evidence from the trial court as to how he did things.
So the statute was, the legislature intended the statute not to permit a court to hold two hearings on the same day, one for conviction number two and an afternoon for conviction number three, that's what the statute, have we ever said that?
The statute intended there to be clearly sequenced convictions. And so I suppose so. The trial court could have said, I'm going to have the clerk type up this order and I'm going to sign it and we'll take a 20-minute recess and we'll reconvene and do trial number two. The trial court could have done that.
Or have a single hearing and there's two pieces of paper on the desk and say, which one am I supposed to sign first? Okay, got that. I'll sign this one. We don't even know if that happened.
But certainly on appeal, the appellant bears most of the burdens. But in this case, there still has to be sufficient evidence. This is a statutory interpretation issue, and so we need to be able to see from the record when the trial court found that Mr. Lewis had twice previously been convicted of assault and battery on a family or household member. We need to be able to see those convictions.
Well, surely, Justice Kelsey, it has to be right that if there's proof of the sequence, it complies with the statute. The problem is there is no proof one way or the other in this case. That's the problem. And the question that's being put to you now is surely you don't mean that if you could have the proof that you couldn't do it according to the statute.
Surely we have to be right about that. Certainly, Your Honor. And certainly the trial court, I suppose, could have written a time in or written, had the clerk or either himself written in a sentence on the order saying this precedes the order in case number whatever the second case number of the case may be, and there could have been some indicia of that. But while I may bear most of the burdens in this case for Mr. Lewis, the trial court does bear the burden of showing that Mr. Lewis twice previously had been convicted of assault and battery.
No, the trial court doesn't have any burden. The Commonwealth has
the Commonwealth problems.
Well, let me take you back a step, too, because I think you alluded to this in answering the Chief Justice's questions, that you agree that the convictions happened on May 16, 2016.
Yes, sir.
And your position is, at trial, the conviction hadn't happened, and therefore the Commonwealth could not prove its case, and that's why you'd be entitled to relief.
Yes, sir.
Because the interesting thing about this statute, which is unlike, say, the sentencing on the use of a firearm statute, is that the legislature specifically stated that the fact that there has been two convictions has to be in the indictment. So wouldn't that indicate that it has to be proven at trial that there have been two convictions?
Well, that's my point, and it relates more. I made that point more in assignment of error number one, but the indictment has to say twice previously been convicted of one of the predicate crimes. And in this case, it was impossible for the Commonwealth to offer that proof at the trial of the matter. And so,
how do you distinguish Ansel? Ansel was second or subsequent conviction, and the holding was three separate offenses committed on the same day and tried together. And there's no evidence at all as to paperwork sequencing at the hearing.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. Ansel relies on 18253.1, which, if you read the language of that statute, it doesn't matter When those convictions happen, it simply says first conviction 3 years, second or subsequent 5 years. And so under that statutory framework, it's perfectly appropriate to get 3 years and then multiple 5-year sentences all on the same day, as long once you enter the conviction, first one 3 years, the rest of them are 5 years. That's different in the language.
And isn't the distinction between this case and Ansel that in Ansel it had to do with enhancement of a penalty, which happens at sentencing, whereas in this case it's an element of the crime,
yes,
as to whether or not the conviction is taken?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Goff, under the circumstances of this case where we have taken up a huge amount of your time, you'll have 2 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. With respect to the first assignment of error and the timing of the predicate offenses, in light of the Court's questioning and my opposing counsel's argument, I'd like to rest on my brief with that, unless the Court has specific questions.
I'm not going to quite let you do that.
Sure.
And frankly, I'm going to ask you questions that I would prefer to ask the Commonwealth's attorney. The Commonwealth's attorney isn't here, so I can only ask you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. The indictment occurred in March of 2016. A grand jury was shown the statute upon a conviction for assault and battery against a family or household member where it is alleged in the ... indictment on which a person is convicted that such person has been previously convicted of two offenses against a family or household member. What are the two offenses that were shown to the grand jury in order for the indictment to be issued?
I don't know that, Your Honor. It's not reflected in the record.
Okay.
Were there some priors, though, that separate and independent,
yeah,
from the one that's at issue? That's the puzzling thing to me.
Yes, Your Honor. So the pre-sentence report in this case, which is in this court's record, it's a sealed record, demonstrates the defendant did have at that time two prior convictions for assault and battery of a family member.
There's one that we know of.
Yes.
And that's the one from 2000, offense date 2007, order date 2011.
Yes.
But other than that, there's simply a reference, a rather oblique reference, to something where we have no order that was ever given to the trial court.
Certainly, Your Honor. Although if we're talking about what was given to the grand jury, well, we can't be sure, there was a conviction in existence at the time this matter was presented to the grand jury.
It would appear to be, but that has not been established as a matter of fact in the record that is before us.
No, Your Honor. And the Commonwealth is not required to use the same two convictions that it presented to the grand jury to obtain a conviction.
Which then gets me to my next question. I'm not sure that I concede that, but it doesn't matter since neither you nor I know. But the next question is, at the time of trial, the Commonwealth moved to amend the October indictment to allege to try a misdemeanor instead of a felony.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was presumably because the Commonwealth thought it had two convictions going in and realized at some point between indictment and trial that it actually was going to have to bootstrap one of them.
Correct? Yes, Your Honor. And this is speculation, but that may have been as simple as something as that maybe someone didn't get the certified order from the other court that they wanted.
And that's the likely scenario, but nonetheless, it would... Never mind. I'm editorializing at this point. Thank you,
sir.
Well, now, there's no challenge to the indictment in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor. Correct.
So whatever imperfections there may or may not have been in the indictment have all been waived.
Yes.
Right.
That's correct, Your Honor. The assignment of error in this case is limited to the statutory sufficiency of the Commonwealth's evidence to convict the defendant of these offenses. And there is no, I said that I was going to rest on my brief with this regard, but there is no timing requirement with regard to the existence of those prior offenses.
What did the trial court mean when the trial court said, ruling on this very issue, and then the court took judicial notice of the fact that he was also found guilty of assault and battery of a family member under the same code section previously to today. So I think the judge said that's sufficient evidence to overrule the motion on that. So previously to today, what is the trial court referring to?
My understanding of that, Your Honor, was it was referring to the sequential nature of the trials in this case.
Okay, so there's been a finding from the bench, I find you guilty. Then he enters an order that presupposes that the or inferentially presupposes that that order was entered in the proper sequence, and we don't have a record that tells us otherwise.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would also submit that while the trial court speaks through its record, where the transcript is not inconsistent with those orders, this court can look to the transcript to clarify, for example, the order of the proceedings in this case.
Well, the question I'm after is a little different. I'm wondering if the problem here is we don't have a transcript. If the issue is what piece of paper got signed first, if that's the legal issue in the case, we don't know. And they say, well, it's insufficient under our theory, and if that's true, why isn't the answer, well, we don't know. You didn't give us, you don't present any evidence one way or the other on it. That is a record of what the trial court did that day. And the inference is the trial court understood some sequencing because he talked about it being previously done, and then he enters an order that is a second and subsequent order, which infers that he did sequence it right.
Yes, Your Honor, and there's also a presumption of regularity that attaches to the trial court's proceedings. The trial court is presumed to know and follow the law, and given that we know for a fact that these convictions did occur sequentially, it would make sense to not infer contrary to that presumption. But I would note significantly that this particular issue that we're grappling with regarding the convictions was not raised before the trial court. And the trial court was never told that it needed to enter a particular conviction order in any sequence. And so to the extent this issue was not raised before the court below, it may explain the lack of a record in particular, and it shouldn't be held as this court's basis for decision in this regard.
Well, on the part about taking judicial notice of a prior conviction prior to today, does that mean June 9th, 2011? Because it can't mean May 16th, because that is the day. So it
yes,
can't
sir.
Be prior to the day it is. So is it June 9th?
I think the court is just referring to the prior proceeding. I'm not aware that there was any other conviction before the court at that time that the court could be referencing. To the extent that that's an imprecise language,
well,
I don't believe.
It goes right to the heart of the question. Maybe we don't know it. Maybe we'll never know it. But prior to today, on May 16th, cannot mean May 16th. You certainly would agree with that.
Yes, Your
Honor. So prior to today is a non sequitur on this record that we have, which consists of only orders that are signed. Now, if it's a sequence of what happened during the course of the day, then it wouldn't be prior to today. It would be prior to the entry of this order. Now, that could, in fact, sweep within it something that had been done an hour earlier or even 3 minutes earlier. But we don't know, do we?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that that is parsing the trial court's words too closely. I think this court heard in the last case that the court is not that the court shouldn't pull isolated statements of the trial court out and use them to hold that the court ruled incorrectly. That statement, what's going on here today, I believe the only reference, the only way to read that in context of what just occurred, was that the trial court is referring to the second sequential trial, not that the court didn't understand that there wasn't more than one conviction before it or that it didn't understand the sequence of events there. I think the court just misspoke in saying
that. Did the defendant ever argue in the trial court the questions we're now asking about, which is, Judge, you can enter the orders the same day, but one has to be technically signed and entered before the other one? Or did the defendant argue, no, it can't be done the same day. It's got to be done the day before or some earlier day?
The defendant's argument in the trial court, which I believe is Appendix 95 to 100, is that the Commonwealth was required to prove sentence and final judgment before a conviction could count as a conviction.
Okay, so there was never any debate as to the timing of the entry of the conviction order. They thought that was not off the boards from the start. You had to have a sentencing order.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
So the debate we're having really was never raised to the trial judge, and for all we know, the trial judge could have answered it if someone had raised it.
Or entered an order at that time. And one of the laudatory purposes of 525, of course, is to give the opposing party the opportunity to meet the objection. And certainly had this particular objection been raised, the Commonwealth would have had the opportunity to build a record on this point before the court. And because the issue was not raised, neither the trial judge nor the Commonwealth had an opportunity to build a record.
So in theory, if I'm a trial judge and I find out there's some sequencing paperwork issue that I have to do, and I found out I made a mistake, I signed the wrong thing first, I could vacate both orders and enter them properly.
Yes, Your Honor, or draft the particular language of the order to reflect that one was entered before the second one.
Ms. Fitzgerald, in order to just get the position straight, it seems to me that appellant says and his preferred view of the statute is that a conviction doesn't occur until sentencing. But an alternative view that he has, and he's advancing, is that it occurs when there's a conviction order and doesn't require sentencing. Your position, it seems to me, goes from the other side and ends up in the same place. Your first position is as soon as the guilt has been pronounced, it's a conviction. But the alternative view is that when a conviction order is actually entered, certainly that is a conviction. Is that stretching the positions that both of you have?
I don't think so, Your Honor. However, I would emphasize that the Commonwealth's position is that a conviction is proven when the defendant, in this case, was convicted by the trial court, convicted meaning nothing more than the entry of guilt. And that, in the recidivist context, is right in line with this court's interpretation of the word convicted in the Ansel and Flood cases, where, particular to the recidivist conduct, the Commonwealth was able to prove multiple recidivist violations within a single trial. And so necessarily in that context, no conviction order was necessary, or no final judgment order was necessary in order for the Commonwealth to meet its burden.
And I thought we had cleared up the confusion on that issue in the Starrs case. We had a series of cases going way back that said a guilty plea is a self-supplied conviction. So all of a sudden we said, well, that's enough. I mean, that's a conviction. But in Starrs, we said when a guilty plea is a self-supplied conviction, it is only when a trial court has entered a written order finding the defendant guilty that it has made a determination of the rights of the parties, etc. So we fixed that issue, I think, in Starrs.
Yes, Your Honor. However, there the court was dealing with what the trial court's authority moving forward was, and found that after the formal finding of guilt was entered, the trial court had no ability to then go back and do anything other than impose the sentence prescribed by the legislature.
Oh,
so when you're talking about defining the trial court's discretionary bounds, I think it's a little bit different of a situation than we're dealing with here in this context.
Well, I don't think it's different, though. I tell you, it's a different setting, but it's the same principle. Once you enter an order of conviction, you have made a decision. You can't dismiss it. You can't conditionally dismiss it. You can't do anything, because that's the finality.
You could set aside that conviction, Your Honor. You could set aside that conviction. Right. You could modify, vacate, or suspend it within 21 days. You could appeal that conviction. I mean, there are a number of ways in which even when we say something is a final conviction, that it's not necessarily as final as we'd like to think it is with post-conviction proceedings, et cetera. So the finality of that moment, of the trial court's discretional boundaries, is a different question than whether under the recidivist context, when we're talking about someone's repeated violent behavior and the General Assembly's intention to deter that repeated violent behavior, we're looking at a different legislative intent, a different context.
The problem is that this statute makes the prior conviction an element of the offense. And so the reason why you want this to be decided is for the certainty of what has to be proven in order to get a felony conviction rather than a misdemeanor on the next charge.
Certainly, Your Honor. However, in the sentencing context, under the Supreme Court's line of cases in Apprendi, the Commonwealth has the same burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt to prove those aggravators under the conviction of a firearm by a convicted felon statute. Commonwealth's burden is the same and the concerns are the same. Nevertheless, this Court has held specific to the recidivist context that in those circumstances it would defeat the intent of the General Assembly to allow the defendant to have the benefit of first offender status while he repeats his violent actions simply because he hasn't been captured in the meantime. And here in this case, the Commonwealth specifically proffered that these cases were brought together because the defendant had not been arrested until after his second offense.
Let me ask you this. I take it your primary position is once the court verbally says guilty, that's the conviction, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's say in some other circuit court, we have one of these proceedings, and so Commonwealth tenders, hey, here's a transcript, whatever. So he's guilty, he's a felony recidivist. So, but then meanwhile, in this parallel proceeding, the court reconsiders. Don't we have the risk, not that that happens often, but don't we have the risk of someone being convicted as a felon based on this predicate of a verbal pronouncement of conviction and then later it's modified or vacated or whatever, where does that leave this other felony conviction?
Certainly, Your Honor, and I think that would be a sufficiency issue. It would go to the weight of that evidence for the trial court to consider. Unlike the circumstance that Your Honor has posed here, the trial court just heard that trial, heard the defendant testify and admit that he struck the victim, heard counsel admit that that testimony was sufficient for a finding of guilt. This is not a case where the trial judge was left to speculate regarding proceedings happening in another jurisdiction. And in that case, maybe the trial court would not place as much weight on that type of evidence presented by the Commonwealth. But the Commonwealth is entitled to prove its case by any competent evidence. It's not required to elect its proofs under this court's decision in Boone. And the decision in this case to go forward with the trial that that particular trial judge had just heard, where the defendant admitted striking the victim and where counsel admitted that that testimony was sufficient for a conviction, that is reliable evidence. And certainly met the Commonwealth burden to prove prima facie evidence of that conviction.
Ms. Fitzgerald, I think we crossed that bridge a while ago. In the case of Smith versus Commonwealth in 1922, it was the Commonwealth's attorney in Virginia that was charged with a federal offense. He was found guilty, and immediately in the federal court found guilty. Immediately in the state court, they sought to remove him because he had been convicted. That case went up on appeal to this court, and this court said the word convicted in the statute in question means convicted by judgment and requires a judgment of conviction in addition to the verdict of the jury. Isn't that exactly what Justice McCullough is talking about? We need to have the finality of it when it becomes an element in another offense.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think Smith controls, though, given this court's subsequent case law. This court's decisions, again, in Ansel and Fleiss, this court's most recent decision in Gillespie, all of those cases, I think the language from Smith is that the ascertainment of guilt bears upon the status or rights of an individual in a subsequent case. In all of this court's subsequent case law, the individual status or rights were being impacted by the use of those convictions. Nevertheless, this court has found in multiple other circumstances that convicted or conviction means simply what it says and nothing more. So I think that this court's body of law has been that this word can be construed differently in different contexts. And the closest context to what we have here, again, is that recidivist statute in the recidivist context, rather than in the Smith context, in the removal of an elected official context, that this word simply means conviction. And this is supported by the legislative history of this particular statute, where the General Assembly had the opportunity to use the word sentenced instead of the word convicted when looking at the closest existing statute at that time, which was the predecessor to our current petty larceny statute, which used to provide that the defendant had been before sentenced three times. And that was in 1991 when this was put on the books. So this court's case law, in conjunction with the specific legislative history and the recidivist context in which we find ourselves.
Well, there's a certain amount of fairness to this because you're over 2 minutes, and now he's going to get 2 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd ask the court to affirm.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly to touch on the last point, certainly 57.2 is a recidivist statute, but I do take issue with opposing counsel's brief and saying this is more akin to 18.253.1. This court and the Court of Appeals have made clear that 53.1 is a strictly punitive statute.
Can I interrupt you, though, here? Tell me if I'm right or wrong. I read your appellate brief and I read the trial court record to suggest that the argument that was made in both situations was the conviction under the statute included the guilt order and the sentencing order, right?
Yes, sir.
I don't see anything, and it could very well be there. All you got to do is point me to it, where you ever said at the lower court, or for that matter in your appellate brief, that no, it can be the conviction order, alternatively. It can be a conviction order that's only guilt, but the guilt order's got to be entered on the same day, if it is entered that day, prior to the other guilt order. I don't see that anywhere being argued in the trial court or in your appellate brief. It's a great point and a very fascinating legal question. I just don't know if you've made it. If you have, can you point me to it?
Well, Your Honor, obviously, as the court correctly pointed out, my position was at trial that a conviction for purposes of 18.257.2 was not...
Was a guilt order plus a sentencing order. Did you ever argue that a guilt order in an alternative could be sufficient, but only if it's entered sequentially prior to the final guilt order?
I think that's not incorrect, but it's a little unfair. I think you have to look at the context of what happened. The prosecutor at Appendix 97 says, I would propose to make a proffer of the information to be available in a certified copy, and she went through to identify what that information would be. The court responded that it will take judicial notice of the fact that Mr. Lewis...
Let me help you out. You're almost out of time. Where did you make this argument in your appellate brief? I just got through skimming it while she was talking. I don't see the argument anywhere in the appellate brief that a conviction order is sufficient if it's a guilt finding only, not sentencing, so long as it's sequenced before the other guilt order.
I object to the court making that finding of fact a conviction. The statute calls for convictions. Go on to state. But the issue about the conviction order of May 16th, that's stating very basic legal principles that a court speaks only through its orders. So no, certainly that conversation wasn't had, but that's fairly elementary that a circuit court only speaks through its orders. And so if the court rejects my more expansive position, they still did not introduce that essential element of the offense on the date of trial as they were required to do.
All right, your time has expired. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.